This is an Equity Bates Media podcast.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Equity Minds.
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is useful.
Equity.
Welcome to another episode of Equity Mates, a podcast where we help you learn to invest in 45 minutes or less. We break down the world of investing from beginning to dividend so that you can hopefully make some returns. My name's Bryce, and as always, I'm joined by my equity buddy, Ren. How's it going, bro?
I'm very good, Bryce. Very excited for this interview. We are getting stuck into the smaller end of the market, and that's a big focus or big interest for me, the small and mid-cap space, and we've got a true expert here to help us understand it and unpack it.
We do. We are fortunate enough to be joined on the show this evening by Nick Cregan. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, guys. Appreciate your time and your interest.
So Nicholas has 17 years investment experience in both domestic, US and international markets. He's currently the partner and portfolio manager at Fairlight Asset Management, and is an expert in global small and mid-cap stocks, which Ren mentioned is a particular interest of ours. And Nick focuses in on technology, healthcare, light industrials, and consumer staples. So look, we're going to pick his brains when it comes to the process of finding small caps and how we should be thinking about small caps, small to mid-cap stocks in our portfolio. So let's do it.
Yeah, and we've even got a few specific stocks that we're going to unpack. But before we do all that, we like to start with a game. The game is overrated or underrated, and so we'll get stuck into that now. So Nick, first up, we'll start domestically at home. Overrated or underrated, the ASX 200 index?
Very good question, and I think it depends on whether you're looking at it from a historic or a prospective basis, and I don't want to put the boot in too hard here because Credit Suisse did a study and they were able to show that Australia has been the best performing index from 1900 all the way through to 2019, beating both the US and the European indices. So it's hardly been what you'd call a slouch, but that performance has come from a reasonably narrow contingency of stocks. So just under 50% of the ASX 200 is comprised of financials. A big portion of that, of course, is the banks and resource stocks. So any sort of reversal of any of those trends driving the Australian economy over the last 30 years would leave investors pretty exposed. It's also quite expensive, acknowledging interest rates are quite low, but the index itself is quite expensive. So from my point of view, overrated.
Fascinating. That's such an interesting stat. Definitely going to pull that one out.
Yeah. So it's been a wonderful place to be historically, but some of the potential headwinds coming up could be a bit of an issue for Australia as we sort of dive into some of the details through the talk, I think.
So, Nick, overrated or underrated the NASDAQ 100?
Well, once again, if we include Facebook, Amazon, Netflix and Google as part of the S&P 500, the tech sector now makes up a record 37% of the S&P 500, which is pretty interesting because you think that that actually peaked at less than 35% during the tech bubble of 99-2000. Of course, the major difference this time around is there's actually some real businesses with wonderful cash flow and growth opportunities. So there's no doubting that the amount of junk that was in that index going back to 99 was pretty horrific. But once again, from a valuation standpoint, they're incredibly expensive and probably due to a high proportion of Robinhood investors and greater and probably greater representation with the ETF market as well. So from my point of view, once again, overrated. Mm.
So if we move back home, Australians obviously love property, but we want to get your thoughts on it. So overrated or underrated Australian residential property?
Great question. I think you can look at this topic through a couple of different lenses. And the first one being financial, the question really is, do we think it's reasonable to expect the Australian property market to deliver some kind of reasonable return over the next couple of decades? I'm not sure I've got a great answer for this one, and it hardly wins you any friends raising the topic at a barbecue, because a lot of Australians, I think, and I believe the statistic is we're number two in terms of household debt to GDP after the Swiss. Prices have definitely benefited from a one-way trend in interest rates over the past 20 years. So not really a lot of juice to go there either. And I think Turnbull, who you guys had on the call on the program a few weeks back, made a pretty good point on migration levels. There's reason to believe we've got some stagnation going there. Lending standards are going to come in, and you know it's probably not hard to see why the Australian housing lending is now contracting at the fastest levels we've seen over the past 30 years. So from a pricing perspective, I think it's reasonable to say it's probably overrated. But the other way of looking at it, of course, is through the lens of personal freedom, which I'm sure you guys are probably a little bit more au fait with, and you know, leveraging an asset 10 to 1 doesn't give you a lot of wriggle room and can probably stifle your ability to take risk. So if you wanted to get involved in a new business venture, like launching a podcast, for instance, and having sort of a high percentage of disposable income going to mortgage servicing, it really does put a damper on your entrepreneurial perspective. So from that point of view, I think it's a little bit overrated also.
And podcasting is a highly risky business.
I've just heard over the last few weeks you guys sort of pitching your wares and trying to sort of raise a bit of equity on the side. So I thought from that point.
Are you interested? Should we take this offline?
We would classify as a small cap.
Yes, definitely.
So from that point of view, I think that I think you had Ed from TDM on the line a couple of weeks ago as well, mentioning that he doesn't own residential property. I put myself firmly in that camp as well. So putting our money where our mouth is and into equities.
Well, that was actually going to be my follow-up question, because we had a couple of listeners reach out quite recently actually and have suggested that the follow-up should always be, you know, do you actually own property? Because we have a lot of these investors come on and sort of, you know, give us a lot of reasons why property isn't good, but then they have this big property portfolio sitting behind them. So it's kind of like, you know, are you actually putting your money where your mouth is? So it's actually interesting that you're in that boat.
Yeah, and I think they also, you probably should get the follow-up question from a few of the people who are listening in on, does the fund manager put his money into the fund he's managing as well, which is usually a pretty good indicator of what they sort of think of their own strategy and whether they're willing to back themselves alongside their clients. And to that end, everyone in our team is heavily invested in the fund. So plenty of alignment through Fairlight.
We'll add that one in. And if the fund manager says no, then we've just sunk their funds. So So continuing on, a couple more. Overrated or underrated, the Australian wax stocks. So Wise Tech, Appen, Afterpay, Xero, you know, the big darlings at the moment.
Absolutely. And as you guys know, we at Fairlight invest 100% offshore. So, you know, the limited amount of research I've done on the Australian WiseTech businesses, I can offer some thoughts, but it may not be particularly wise counsel. So take it with a grain of salt. But from the limited reading I've done on WiseTech specifically, it does seem to be quite the collection of prominent warts across its governance and accounting functions. So plenty of red flags for me across the board. Highly acquisitive, it's capitalising its costs, it maybe should be expenses, it uses sort of quirky accounting gimmicks to shelter some of its subsidiaries against what would I think would be pretty appropriate scrutiny. And last but not least, insiders have been dumping stock at quite a rate. So on 20 times sales, I suspect that one's highly overrated. Afterpay is an interesting one and perhaps a little bit misunderstood when the business model first came out. Obviously, the newer generation tend to have less of an affinity with credit cards. So the company has found a genuine fit, but the big question is one of what does steady state look like, and competition really rapidly coming into that part of the market. Do we need one? Do we need five? It's pretty unclear sort of how that market develops. Once again, very, very expensive. Altium, I don't know that much about it other than it's got a pretty large addressable market, but a little bit more defined than the other wax cohorts. Appen, from what I understand, uses sort of humans to help AI train neural nets. So it's certainly in a pretty sexy part of the market, but an impressive customer base. 70% of their revenue is made up of just three customers. So from a concentration point of view, a risk point of view on a big multiple, I'd say it's pretty overrated. And then Xero, which is a genuine success story born out of a pretty unique time when Myob was in private equity hands, and private equity in their infinite wisdom taking a knife to R&D and levering up the balance sheet, maybe allowed Xero to get a little bit of a leg ahead. Very, very impressive business, big runway for growth. As a cohort, however, huge multiples. So all of that sort of good news is really priced into the outlook for the WACC sector. And I think overrated, probably talks a little bit of the narrowness of the Australian market and inability to find great businesses on decent multiples.
Yeah, it's a serious scarcity play.
Yeah, I think so.
So next one, US-China trade war is a very on-again, off-again, will-they-won't-they topic between Trump and Xi Jinping. But overrated or underrated, if the trade war does happen and does really blow up, overrated or underrated, the effect it will have on the Australian economy?
Good question. And looking a little bit of history here is useful. So the last time we had a major downturn, we had a pretty good relationship with China. And they unleashed a huge fiscal credit stimulus in 2009, which was about 10% of GDP to pay for construction of roads, bridges, railways, all that sort of stuff. And most of that, or a great deal of that, was a big misallocation of resources, led to lower productivity. And so this time around, it really does look like the Chinese are a little bit more circumspect in the way that they're spending money. So some of the less commodity intensive projects, such as 5G and charging stations for electric vehicles, seem to be what they're focusing on. But with the backdrop of the rising tensions between the US and Australia this time around, so it's not just the US, but I did notice that we granted 10,000 new visas to existing Australian residents in response to the national security laws imposed by the CCP. We could expect a pretty dramatic impact on Australia's economy. However, it's not yet coming through in the numbers, which is quite interesting. So for the last 6 months to June, the exports to China in terms of iron ore has grew by 10%, and coal was 13%, and LNG was 3%. So it's not really coming through the numbers yet. And of course, offsetting that is the bans on beef, barley, education, etc. So it's very, very difficult to see the situation improving either for the US or for Australia, because it does look like the West is coalescing around the idea of a united front against the perceived aggression of an increasingly assertive Chinese Communist Party. So it doesn't seem like it's going to get any better. And it does really look like the huge stimulus package that we saw last time around isn't going to happen. So to mine, it's underrated in terms of the impact we're going to see over the next few years.
Well, speaking of impact, and to close this out, overrated or underrated the impact of COVID-19 on the Australian economy, or if you've got focus over in the US at the moment on the US economy?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the big question mark is what happens once the stimulus or the paycheck support mechanisms roll off? Is there an appetite for further leverage and support of the consumer? I think that's really going to come down to a policy response. So hard to see that it's going to be positive when we see these responses roll off. And just the sort of violent rebound we've had in equity markets, to mine, it looks like it's a little bit underrated in terms of the impact.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
So, Nick, moving on from the game, we always like to start these questions with the story of someone's first investment. There's generally a good story or a good lesson that comes out of it. So to kick us off tonight, can you tell us the story of your first investment?
Yeah, sure. I thought maybe rather than my first investment, it might be a little bit more constructive in terms of the lessons I learned from one of my first larger investments. And that came about when I was a sell side analyst with the job of analyzing, and I was a young analyst, so in my very early 20s, analyzing and providing research on a terrible business called Hasty Air Conditioning. And there's probably a few people on the call if they're old enough to remember this business, but by all accounts, it really was a terrible business. They had razor thin margins. The working capital profile was horrific. They never got paid on time. They were very acquisitive and they used equity as currency to close deals. So, you know, issuing equity at pretty sort of low valuations. And it really was the cognitive biases at work on my very undeveloped investing mind at that time that brought me unstuck. So we sort of run through sort of three of the major biases there. It's always good to go back and really have a good look at sort of where you thought you were suffering from these. But the first one was overconfidence bias. So I was young and I didn't know what I didn't know, which is, you know, we're all in that spot when we start out. So no problems there. But I had a line into management. So I thought I had a great handle on the operations and the financials of the business. But in reality, I was just close enough to the business that they could feed me sort of all sorts of interesting information that may or may not have relevance. There was all sorts of recency bias. So the stock was pretty new. It had a very short track record, but quite a successful one. But it certainly hadn't been tested by a cycle. And so, you know, it really was a Johnny-come-lately sort of business, and you know, relying on a pretty short track record to figure out whether it was a good business or not. And the last one was confirmation bias. So the nature of the deals they were doing in the short term made the earnings accretion look really terrific, but ultimately it became quite over-leveraged. Many of the founders of the business they bought left. I managed to sell the stock before I lost all my money, but eventually went to zero. But it was a fantastic lesson in, you know, some of the very easy traps we fall into when we get sort of too close to a business and start to look at it through rose-colored glasses, if you like.
Yeah, I love that. You know, we speak about cognitive bias every now and then on the show, and it's something that I think as investors at the early stage of their journey or our journey, it's something we need to consistently remind ourselves of. Are there any sort of biases at the moment that you still need to be very aware of when you're in your day-to-day?
Absolutely. And in fact, we've actually built a number of sort of overrides into our process to overcome some of those. And a lot of what we do is backed by research. So there is a group up in the UK called Analytics that put a study together that showed that active managers, so professional managers, give up about 100 basis points per annum in essentially selling their best ideas too early and adding to their losers too readily. So what's called the disposition effect. So we overcome that by dividing our portfolio into three major buckets. So high quality growth, stable compounders, and low risk turnarounds. And it's really in the high quality growth names that we suffer from that disposition effect more readily. So we're much more patient in the speed in which we sell those businesses. So yes, we're trimming them. We look through the portfolio always through the prism of risk, but it is those businesses that can compound out for long periods of time at high rates of return that can surprise you on the upside. So we build that into our process and tend to hold those businesses a little bit longer than we otherwise would be comfortable with.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Mm. So before we move into some specifics on small and mid caps, I guess you can answer this from a Fairlight asset management point of view, but what is the investing philosophy that you now sort of, I guess, live during your day-to-day?
Yeah, so the philosophy is, and I guess the easiest way to really talk about it is sort of how it's come about, where it's come from, how we arrive there and ultimately what the results have been. But I've been incredibly fortunate that I've been able to distill my personal investing philosophy down into a process that's formed the backbone of the business. And during that journey, I've been lucky enough to work with some wonderful mentors. David Wannis, who's now the founder of Longwave, Jenny Jones in New York, who is one of the best long-term track records investing in US small caps in history, and Stephen Arnold, who's now the founder of Aorus, very hardworking and knowledgeable guy. And then I've now been fortunate enough to partner with some very, very talented people whose philosophy thankfully aligns with mine. And we've taken what's empirically worked for us over the years and cross-checked that with the academic literature to design a process that sets out to build as many market tailwinds as possible into our process before we start looking at specific stocks. So in doing that, what we do is we invest in the smaller cohort of the market, as there's evidence over the last 100 years, and this is put together by academic literature over time, that US smaller caps outperform the general market over about a 100-year period. It doesn't happen every year, but over that sort of time period, there is this tailwind of small caps consistently outperforming large caps. By the way, that's not persistent here in Australia. So Australia is one of the unique markets where actually large caps outperform smalls. But it is persistent across the other developed markets in Europe. So around 90% of the developed markets, smalls outperform large. So that's a starting point. And then everything we do, we look through the prism of risk, as I mentioned earlier. So we don't like sectors that need a lot of debt to drive their returns. And we don't like highly cyclical sectors. So we screen those out as well. We invest only in developed markets where we can rely on the currencies and the reporting standards. So we like to be able to read an annual report, trust the accounting. So very important. You don't always get that in emerging markets. And sometimes the selective disclosure in emerging markets can be quite interesting as well. We love businesses that generate lots of cash. And so we loosely define those businesses as quality companies. You can define quality in lots of different ways, but for us, it's really businesses that generate a lot of cash through the cycle. So typically they've been around for a little while. And then we employ, as I mentioned, three slightly different styles of investing within quality. So we've got growth, we've got what we call stable compounders, and special situations. The growth names, to use a couple of Australian examples, would be sort of your typical CSLs of the world, where you can deploy capitals at very, very high rates of return for long periods of time. The stable compounders are more your Woolies and your Coles, great businesses, and they can sort of eke out GDP type returns, drive some margin, maybe buy back some stock, and you get to reliable 10 to 12% earnings per share outcomes. And then around 10 to 15% of the portfolio is in what we call special situations. And these are turnaround stocks. They're not highly leveraged Ugandan oil explorers, but they're more sort of businesses that are at their core are quality, but they need maybe a management team to be moved along. And we get involved in activists in the US to try and help this process along, or spin-offs. So statistically, spin-offs have generated really good returns over time, less so in the last few years, but certainly over the last couple of decades, spin-offs have been a great place to generate returns. And then at the individual stock level, we don't like leverage. I think that the Russell 2000 at the moment leveraged about 4.5 times cash flow, which is a pretty interesting place to be, whereas the Fairlight portfolio is more like 1 times cash flow, which is very low levels of leverage across the business. We remain really disciplined on valuation. Valuation really hasn't mattered over the last 5 or 6 years. So markets are kind of just rocketed up from bottom left to top right of the page, and valuation hasn't mattered, but it will. Eventually, valuation does matter. And so we've been very, very disciplined there and continue to be. And then we remain diversified from both an underlying economic exposure and a market returns perspective. So we look at correlations, but we also look at the underlying economic exposures of our business. I think most importantly, and this comes down to a bit more of a softer factor, but we foster a culture that openly communicates errors and swiftly terminates our investment mistakes. And I think that one is one of the most important parts of our process, that it really is the communication between our team and how that works that allows us to eliminate errors very, very quickly and protect client capital.
I love that. It's a complete philosophy. Like, there's a lot of elements that we can unpack there, but I think it's a pretty robust one, and it definitely ties together a lot of elements that we hear from a lot of the experts we speak to. So I think if people want to apply a personal investing philosophy for their personal portfolios, maybe they should just clip that and just set it as their alarm every morning or something
so
like that. So if we move to the small and mid-cap space specifically, which is where you're focused and where you're focused on applying that investment philosophy, if we start general, can we start with what your definition is at Fairlight for your investable universe, what small and mid-cap stocks mean to you guys?
Yeah, sure. We keep it pretty simple. So we just say from $500 million up to $20 billion in market cap. So believe it or not, a $20 billion business in the US is still considered mid-cap.
That's crazy.
Jeez.
Yeah, it is crazy. And if you put that into perspective, so if you look at the ASX 200, the median stock, I think it's the average, or maybe it's the median, but it gives us an idea, is $8 billion in terms of the average market cap. So the average weighted market cap across our portfolio is $10 billion. So that should put it into perspective in terms of the range of businesses that are available offshore and just what a minnow at the end of the day the Australian market is. I think we account for about 4% of global market cap.
To put it truly in perspective, $20 billion is what Coles is valued at currently. And from memory, Coles sits in the ASX 20.
Well, there you go. So that's a pretty... That's a pretty good stat, but it's we consistently find businesses that are capped at, you know, 5 to 10 billion that don't have a single analyst covering them. So the raft of sort of, I wouldn't call them undiscovered businesses, but I guess underbroked or underanalyzed businesses is quite stark as compared to the Australian market.
That's fascinating. Such a huge pool of opportunity out there that I guess as Australian investors, it's quite hard to get access to information. How should we as investors early in our journey think about small caps as part of our sort of portfolio?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it gets to the heart of, you know, whether you should be investing directly or if you should be spending your time analyzing managers, quite frankly, because I think where it really comes down to is there's 5,300 stocks in our index. And so I think in a lot of ways, it's become less of an idea of management access, where in the Australian market, perhaps you can sort of wear out a lot of shoe leather and visit a lot of businesses and read a lot of annual reports, and you can get a pretty good picture of what's going on. It's really a matter of distilling the market down to something more manageable. When you start with 5,300 stocks and you want it to, you know, eventually for us anyway, get to a portfolio of 30 to 40, how do you go about doing that? And so we apply, as we indicated through our process, some pretty heavy filters across the market in terms of what we're looking for. And then we apply sort of sector filters, geographic filters, financial filters, etc., to get down to about 200 businesses between the team of four of us that's of some interest. And then we put together a portfolio of 30 to 40 names. That does take some IP, and it does take some time, and it also takes some travel. So we get out on the road and we visit management teams. We try and build relationships with active managers in terms of activists that can help us sort of get to outcomes in some of the businesses we're invested in. From a sort of personal investing point of view, that can be quite difficult to replicate. Mm-hmm. So I think it's almost like you take a barbell approach. I'm a big fan of people holding stocks directly because you just learn a hell of a lot. But also keeping an open mind to the idea that there are reasonable managers out there scrubbing the world for ideas. Maybe it isn't such a bad idea to try and do some work and see if that philosophy aligns with yours. And then, of course, the other way of going about it is, you know, if you're quite happy with market returns, there's always an ability to index. So you can index the MSCI World Index without any troubles. And if you're happy with that market return, then that's a genuine way of gaining access as well.
Yeah, one thing that I've learned through doing this podcast and just, you know, reading and speaking to experts is, in the large cap space, it seems like it's very difficult to generate alpha, but in emerging markets and in small caps, that professional edge still seems to play a major role.
That's very insightful, and you've actually managed to reverse pitch one of the slides in our deck, so thanks very much for that.
That's right. Just credit me when you update the slide.
I will. The data shows exactly that. So, you know, obviously US large caps, incredibly hard index to outperform. Large caps generally difficult, but then as you go out into the quadrants of emerging markets and small caps, the median manager actually, from an active management perspective, actually does add value. I think the number from the last stats I saw was about 2% over the last decade. So your approach there is well-informed.
So for an investor who is unable to get on the plane and go and talk to managers and go through the rigorous filtering process that you guys have at Fairlight, what would you recommend as sort of a key destination or piece of information that you should always start with when it comes to trying to identify a potential small cap?
I guess you can take the approach of, you know, invest in what you know. It's not a bad spot to begin. So the idea of, is there a business or a product or a service that I know quite well that I might be able to sort of generate some sort of edge in? And that's really the Peter Lynch Street sort of approach to investing. If you're an individual investor, that's not a bad spot to start, but I would encourage people to go to the effort of reading the literature that's put out by management. So the annual reports, if you can get your hands on the conference notes and the proxy statements, etc., they can be a wonderful source of information. That's not for everyone. I know that sounds incredibly boring, but if you do genuinely want to back yourself to sort of find some businesses that will outperform over the long term, there's really no substitute for the work you need to do to get to an informed decision. So, you know, there are some wonderful businesses out there that you can sort of read about on blogs and investment letters and the 13Fs, they're called. In fact, if you just Google 13F, there's all sorts of websites that put up managers' letters that you can sort of read through the pages of those and find some interesting ideas. But you really do need to go to first principles and make sure you understand these businesses before you put your hard-earned capital to work.
Mm.
So, Nick, obviously you're not investing in the Australian small cap universe. And as we just discovered, in terms of from a market cap perspective, international small caps and US small caps are a lot larger in some cases than back in Australia. Are there any other key differences that, you know, beginner investors or everyday investors should be really cognizant of when they're thinking about investing in small or mid caps in Australia compared to investing in that market overseas?
Yeah, well, from a starting point of view, the indexes are quite different. So the ASX mid cap index, the largest weight in that index makes up about 6% of the index. So it's pretty concentrated. And around 23% of the index itself is material. So it's not particularly well diversified. But our index, the largest stock is around 30 basis points. So it's very well diversified and it has much better exposure to sort of technology, healthcare, some of the parts of the Australian market where there is less representation. So that's a key input. The second thing is that it's important to know across the board, whether it's in Australia or across the world, that unfortunately the small and mid-cap index does have what we term as a junk problem. So a very large portion, I think it's around 25% of our index, doesn't have earnings. So you want to be very, very selective and careful in which portions of the index you want to invest and where you go fishing. So the first port of call from us, and I would suggest it's a pretty good starting point for anyone else that's doing some work in this part of the market, is try and screen for those businesses that have been profitable for some time. Like, if, by all means, you're going to maybe miss the 20 bagger that's the new concept stock that you know that might go up on news or because it's penetrated some sort of new market. But statistically, you're really putting yourself at a disadvantage if you stick to the businesses that have had a couple of cycles worth of history and they've been profitable through that period. You do eliminate quite a portion of the market, that and that does protect you in terms of, from your starting point, at least you're fishing from the right pond. So I would look over the longer periods and try and screen for those businesses that have been around a bit longer in the small and mid-cap market, whether it's in Australia or across the world.
So, Nick, before we move to some stock-specific chat, just wanted to touch on COVID and this part of the market. Are there any major sort of lessons that you've picked up from investing in this part of the market, given what has happened over sort of the last 3 or 4 months?
Yeah, that's a good question. The first thing is that the market's in much worse shape coming into this downturn than we were last time. So I think I mentioned it before, but the Russell 2000 is levered 4.5 times. So huge amounts of debt through the small cap market, which is a pretty interesting place to be.
Do you just want to briefly explain what that actually means?
Yeah, so there's a metric, and it's a very poor metric, but it's a proxy for cash flow. So as the acronyms EBITDA, so earnings before interest and tax, depreciation and amortization. And it's a input that's used to measure against the debt load in a business. And here the debt load is aggregated up into an index. So essentially showing the debt as compared to EBITDA, which is a proxy for cash flow. So sort of 4.5 years of cash flow to pay down the debt of the index, if that sort of makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, it's much worse than that because I think you guys are students of Buffett and Munger, but they've always sort of very astutely realize that EBITDA is a completely made up number and you know, subject to all sorts of accounting gimmicks, but it's the best sort of proxy that we have. I mean, as long as it's applied consistently over time, it does provide a bit of a indication of where we are from a debt load point of view. So the lesson for us is that coming into COVID and also during COVID, it was the more leveraged parts of the market that performed very, very poorly and probably would have gone on to really face some interesting times if it wasn't for the very aggressive actions of the Federal Reserve in buying, or at least threatening to buy, BBB rated securities and really helping the over-leveraged part of the market. So you really are at the whims of regulators and sort of macro support, if you like, if you're going to be buying highly levered businesses. So from our point of view, it really just re-emphasized that debt gets you into all sorts of issues, making a small issue a big one by applying leverage. So staying away from leverage is a good place to be. The second one is proven business models. So we like businesses that have been in the market for a while and have proven themselves out. But at the same time, we recognize that disruption is real. So we try and keep an open mind to that. Ian and I are a similar sort of age. We came into the market, so Ian being our co-portfolio manager, we came into the markets in the sort of in the ashes of the tech wreck. So we're old enough to know what a cycle looks like, but young enough to know that technology really is, you know, software really is eating the world. So we're mindful that our own existing business models, how have they fared through this period? Have they employed technology in the correct way to sort of help them through? And are they participating in that acceleration of winners that we've seen through the COVID-19 period? So it's been a pretty interesting journey. And also management teams are important. So the underlying management teams of these businesses that are going through this crisis, there really is a bifurcation in how these businesses are being managed. Some businesses taking actions very, very early to shore up balance sheets and to really drive home their competitive advantage during the downturn has been quite stark. And so it really is those three lessons of steering clear of debt, making sure that we understand our business models and making sure they're managed by very capable and aligned management teams.
I think there are lessons that shone through during COVID, but they're probably good lessons for people to keep in mind, whether or not there's a global pandemic raging around the world.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's really been an acceleration of a lot of the trends that we've seen over the last, you know, 10 to 15 years. And it's become a bit of a cliche lately, but I think it's absolutely right that the winners are just sort of accelerating out of the gates and the losers find themselves in a much faster structural decline. So it doesn't take a genius to see what's happening with bricks and mortar retail and in the fashion space, for instance, where a lot of that's moving online. If you don't have a hybrid offering these days, you really are finding yourself in all sorts of difficulty. And then, you know, where services can move online, they have been doing it at an accelerating rate. So certainly some lessons to be found there. The second lesson, of course, is just the importance of the structure in which you're operating with under. And this is just complete luck in some ways in terms of, I think Australia and New Zealand, of course, have done a wonderful job on managing the crisis, but other parts of the world, which have been less responsive from a sort of government point of view, really have struggled. So really the response of government's been a sort of bit of a wake-up call across the board as well, and making sure that you understand the regime in which you're investing in has been quite an important lesson also.
So Nick, at this point, you've talked us through your investing philosophy and the market that you're looking at Fairlight. Now we're really excited to get into some specific stocks that you're looking at. And we're particularly excited because it's three stocks that we've never heard of and probably a lot of our listeners have never heard of. So forget the Microsoft and Amazon conversation. This is going to be a conversation where we learn a lot and we're excited to unpack your process, how you found the stocks, how you analyzed them, and why you thought they were interesting ones to buy. So we'll start with the first one. The first one is called Ritchie Brothers and they are auctioneers in industrial asset disposition and management company. I've just pulled their explanations and I think there might be a typo there. But what they do is they help facilitate the selling of heavy industrial equipment and trucks through live and online auctions. So can you talk us through a little bit about this company and then perhaps how you first discovered it?
What's the market cap on this one? 19B?
I think it's one of the small ones. I think it's around 8 billion, but I'll have to double check that number.
Yeah, exactly.
But well, taking a step back, at Fairlight, we really quite like these niche network businesses because if they scale correctly, they tend to deliver incredible value over time. In fact, I was reading a study pretty recently that suggests around 70% of the value created in the tech sector since the 1970s has been driven by pretty successful iterations of network-based business models. So we hold quite a few of these. They don't have to be particularly intuitive. So they're network businesses that operate across insurance, vehicle scrappage, credit reporting services, financial benchmarking. And in fact, our portfolio is made up of about 30% of these kind of really interesting niche networking businesses that they don't really appear in the media all that often. So to your point, you know, the FANG stock's pretty well known. But as a cohort, the FANG stocks are about 22 years old, whereas the businesses that we hold have an average age of around 44 years, which to my point earlier about understanding longevity and dependency of these businesses sort of really corroborates with that story. So with Ritchie Brothers, starting off on what they do, so you can think of them as really auctioneers, if you like, of everything that's yellow. So if you think about Caterpillar trucks, mining equipment, sort of all this heavy equipment that you see as you're sort of driving through construction sites or roadworks or mining operations, they're the largest globally. So they've got a market share lead, which is a great place to be and where you need to be really if you're going to be building a network business, but they command only 2% of the global market share. So they've got a huge runway for growth. And it's that classic network marketplace. So the more equipment they sell, begets more buyers, and then on and on that flywheel spins because more product attracts more customers over time. The investment case actually became pretty interesting back in 2015. As a gentleman by the name of Ravi Selagram joined the business after recently negotiating the merger between two businesses in the US called OfficeMax and Office Depot, and he did a terrific job on extracting some value for his shareholders. But he had what we thought was an incredibly coherent strategy for driving sales growth, margins, and ultimately the cash this business was going to generate over around about a five-year journey. And so he went about doing that in a number of different ways. But one of the most important things that he did was he recognized that the number two competitor, a business called Iron Planet, had a wonderful digital footprint, but didn't have much in the way of sales. So he was able to pick up what was a fantastic digital asset for a pretty reasonable multiple because Iron Planet hadn't bridged the gap between the old model and the new. So they didn't have enough salespeople to drive that velocity that you need to get that flywheel spinning, but they'd spent a hell of a lot of money on their digital footprint. So we had a situation where Ravi came into the business. He started to digitize the business, which meant that, you know, margins naturally start to expand, but you don't need as many physical lots either. So the land banks that they required to store their equipment and have people on site to sort of bang the hammer down and drive these sales is much lower as well. So returns on capital started to rise, and that money went into paying down the debt that he'd accrued on the balance sheet from doing this deal. So we accelerate to COVID. We now find ourselves in a situation where the competitor set that Ritchie Brothers is now competing against are sort of local auctioneers and maybe state-based auctioneers owned by maybe sophisticated families or private equity, but don't have that digital footprint that's required to service the market in a COVID-like environment. And that sort of comes down to my point earlier about understanding your business model during COVID-19 and understanding whether it's going to be part of the winner or the loser cohort. And we think that Ritchie Brothers is certainly going to be part of that winner cohort, taking nice swaths of market share away from their competitors during this lockdown period. So it's a really interesting business. It's driven nice returns for the portfolio, and we think it's got a very, very nice runway for growth over the next couple of decades.
Yeah, fascinating. And it's certainly become evident that COVID is, you know, those businesses that have set themselves up with a digital capacity, or as you say, digital footprint, are certainly able to take advantage of what's going on at the moment. Are you able to just take a step back and sort of define for those that have just joined the show what the key sort of aspects or characteristics of a network business are?
Yeah, sure. So the main sort of characteristic of a network is really having a set of buyers on one side and a set of sellers on the other. So you can think of the eBays of the world, the Amazons, where you're really building a focal point for buyers and sellers to come together to transact in a highly efficient way. And the way that these businesses build out over time is it becomes a sort of self-reinforcing competitive advantage where essentially, as long as you are the go-to provider of a service, you end up with a disproportionate amount of the product or inventory. And it doesn't really matter what that product or inventory is. As long as you've got the most of it, you just become the natural go-to spot for that product or service. And so in this case, for Ritchie Brothers, it's something as niche as yellow equipment that needs to be sort of on-sold and moved through the process of the businesses that have got too much inventory, or they might have found themselves in a downturn like we have at the moment where they've got excess equipment and they need to move that on pretty quickly. The best place for them to realize value for that equipment in the most efficient way is through Ritchie Brothers because they've got the largest amount of sellers. So it's really that intersection between buyers and sellers and how you can act as an agent in between those to drive that network effect.
So Nick, it sounds like a big catalyst for growth for this company was management and was the incoming CEO who, you know, as you explained, acquired the largest competitor and all their digital assets and shifted the focus of the business. That CEO has now moved on and there's a new CEO in his place. How do you think about that where, you know, such an important part of the growth story was the management and that management changes? What's your process to then sort of reassess your position and understand if you want to continue holding with new management in place?
That's a very good question. But one of the key elements that gave us some confidence there was that Ravi communicated very, very early on that this was going to be his last hurrah. So his strategy that he put in place was over a 5-year period. And he said, at the end of this, I'm going to retire and I'm going to hand this business on to someone that's going to sort of guide the business through a different stage of its journey. Sometimes the person, the guy or the girl that's in charge of the turnaround or setting the strategy isn't always the best person to drive the business in a steady state. And that's certainly the case with Ravi, who's a little bit more of a visionary in some ways. And I think that, you know, once the strategy was in place, it was certainly showing the fruits of his labour, handing that over to a manager that was happy to do sort of the harder yards and extracting longer term value made a lot of sense to us. There's also a lot of continuity amongst other members of the management team. So CFO, COO remains in place. The strategy remains identical and the board members are executing against that. So from our point of view, that was fine, but it does definitely in many instances raise some red flags, especially where that's combined with other elements such as insider selling or sort of turnover amongst employees at the more junior ranks as well. So we try and sort of balance those views against what else is going on in the business.
So for those interested in Ritchie Brothers, the ticker is RBA. Easy to remember. You can go and check that out. So let's move on to the sector.
Traded in Canada. Is that right, Nick?
It's actually listed on both the US and the Canadian bourses. So you can get exposure through either one.
So if we move to the next stock, Nick, which is Verisk Analytics, if you want to give us a bit of a rundown on what they do and again, what is the thesis behind this one?
Yeah, we love the intersection between incredibly boring and incredibly complex. And so Verisk definitely fits the bill here. So I don't think we're going to win any awards for the sexiest stock in the world, but
can't be less sexy than auctioneer trading heavy machinery. But
yeah, so it gets even more niche. And I guess that this is where great investing or great returns don't necessarily have to correlate with the most interesting of stories. But Verisk, what they do is you actually have to go back quite some time to understand the business. And it was actually born out of the McLaren-Ferguson Act of 1945, which actually brought this business together. And essentially what Verisk does, it's at its core, it's a contributory database for the property and casualty insurance market. And so one of the best examples or easiest ways to explain it would be every time there's a policy written or there's a claim made against an insurance policy, that information is contributed to Verisk across all the different insurance companies in the US into a contributory database. And that information is used to price the policies and understand whether there's fraud. So maybe if Bryce had totaled his car in California, he couldn't also make that claim in Arizona, for instance, so that you don't get sort of this sense of fraud across state borders. Now, the reason why I'll give you that history is that it was a state-based business back in 1945, and it was actually exempt from the antitrust laws in that time because the legislators realized that it was very, very important for insurers to have this centralized database that allowed them to understand if they were being defrauded or not. So if we accelerate through to 2008, 2009, that business was listed and they're managing sort of 4.5 billion statistical records a year, and they're cleansing that data and they're extracting a little bit of financial rent and selling it back to the insurance companies. But it's essentially a monopoly. I mean, there's just no way that you can replace that data set because they've got the historical data going back all of that time. And they've got all these insurance companies that have no incentive to create a competitor, mainly because it's such a small cost to their overall operation. So you have this niche contributory database, which generates phenomenal margins, you know, margins in the sort of 40% range, very, very consistent organic growth because they have a little bit of pricing power and they pick up new customers and use the data in interesting ways. And it gets to a business that generates sort of really nice, consistent 10 to 12% earnings per share outcomes every year. And that compounds out over a long period of time and drives great returns for shareholders. So, you know, it's not Apple, it's not Google, it's not sexy, but it's an incredibly profitable business that's delivered great returns for our fund.
So would Lemonade be a customer of Verisk?
It's a very good question. You're going to have to tell me who Lemonade is, and then I'll be able to give you that.
They're a company that recently IPO'd in the States that use artificial intelligence to, what sounds like, analyze this sort of data that Verisk would be housing and then create much more specific premiums for insurance companies based on the customer rather than, I guess, like a more of a blanket premium approach, you know, your traditional insurers currently offer. So maybe it's a competitor for Verisk, I'm not sure, but...
It could well be, but it sounds pretty likely they'll be a customer because they'd probably be buying that data and running. I'd say so. I mean, I'll have a look and come back to you guys to make sure I cross that off. But
first thing tomorrow morning, Nick, when you go to the office,
I'll do my homework and shoot that through.
So, Nick, I'm looking at the history of Verisk since it was listed, and it looks like there's been a number of acquisitions over time. It seems to pretty consistently acquire a business every year, but maybe every couple of years. How do you think about a company that is sort of constantly acquiring? Do you think that's value destructive, or do you look at that as a positive and think of it as, you know, adding value?
It really depends on the company. So it's very hard to deny statistically, and there's been a lot of studies done over time on this topic that acquisitions in aggregate provide value. So in aggregate, we think that acquisitions destroy value. And I think there was a paper put together by McKinsey that really went into detail on this. But there is a cohort of businesses that do it well. And there are some that are set up that to do it specifically this. We actually have a smaller list of stocks, about five or six, that operate in some pretty interesting geographies up in Sweden and the Nordics and over the UK and a couple in the US that do an absolutely amazing job of what is really set up to be capital allocation businesses. They buy companies on very nice earnings yields of sort of 12 and 15%. And they don't consolidate those operations. They let those businesses run as almost entrepreneurial units, reinvest the cash flows into new businesses. And they've been really successful over sort of 20 to 30 years. So it's hard to sort of paint the picture of those being the traditional, highly leveraged and risky roll-up story. They are actually successful businesses. Now, as that refers to Verisk is a little different from that. So they've got a core operations and they use those cash flows to either launch or buy other businesses where they think they can add some value. And one of the opportunities we had to buy into Verisk was when they made an acquisition that wasn't particularly well liked by the market, and that was one called Woodmac, which services, of all things, the oil and gas market, where arguably Verisk doesn't have a competitive advantage and don't have a lot of history in understanding that market. And quite rightly, I think at the time, equity markets decided to sort of mark down the value of Verisk based on the fact that it could be perceived to be quite risky. As it's turned out, however, Verisk has done an amazing job with that business. And the reason for that is it wasn't so much where the business was situated, but the kind of IP and knowledge that you need to build within that operation to drive returns. So the kind of statistical analysis and machine learning AI that employed on the insurance side wasn't being employed very particularly well within Woodmac, which was aggregating data that was used by oil and gas companies to figure out whether they should be purchasing a new well or starting new operations based on flow rates of existing assets, et cetera. The data just wasn't used particularly well. They had a great client base, they had a great product, but the learnings that they could bring from their core business into Woodmac was actually pretty impressive. So that they've actually gone on to drive margins up by, I think, a few hundred basis points. Organic growth rates have been, as of sort of before COVID, pretty good. And now we've hit this sort of kink in the road at the moment where so oil and gas is under some pretty terrific pressure. But the characteristics of that business is pretty strong because they have long-term contracts, sort of like SaaS-based contracts within their customer base. So their customer base literally has to go broke before they stop using some of those Woodmac assets. So I think they do a pretty good job, and it has come through on the returns on capital numbers, and it has come through on the earnings per share. So we give them a bit of a passing grade on the capital allocation side.
Now, I'm reading here that when Verisk IPO'd in 2009, Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's company, was a large shareholder and chose not to sell, one of the few large shareholders not to sell any stock at the IPO. I guess that lends itself to a larger question, which is when you're analyzing companies like this, how much are you looking at other experts, other asset managers, companies like Berkshire Hathaway, and sort of reading into what they're doing and potentially taking cues from their buying and selling actions?
Yeah, I mean, we don't mind standing on the shoulders of giants, right? We're humble enough to say that there's some guys out there that do an amazing job in screening stocks and investing. And so if a portion of the hard work's been done for us by looking at the share registry and seeing if there's a bunch of guys that we respect that are already there, then it will at least raise our eyebrows. So, for instance, if there's going through our screening process, if we get the stocks down to sort of a list of 200 and we'd run some pretty automated processes across those to screen them down further. If as part of our first investment committee discussion, we look at the register and see that, you know, the likes of a Warren Buffett or a Choose Your Poison is on the register, then absolutely we will become a little bit more interested in that business. But it certainly doesn't determine our investment decisions. In fact, we found ourselves betting against some of the most respected investors in the market and doing quite okay out of that. And a lot of that comes down to, you know, you don't know the reasons why that investor's selling either. They might be repositioning their portfolio or they might be buying for similar reasons. So whilst it is a good indicator, it's not the be all or end all. So we do definitely take that element with a grain of salt.
Now, you've thrown the bait out there for me and I have to buy it. You said you went against a big investor and you were successful. Would you like to call out the investor that you were right against and tell us the trade?
Well, there's been quite a few that have gone the other way as well. So I don't want to give you the impression that we're always right. That's certainly not the case. But I think even in this one, right, I'm not too sure that Berkshire Hathaway is still in Veris.
No, it looks like they sold 2018.
Right. Okay. So the stock's done very, very well since then. So that would be sort of the first starting point that, you know, the race certainly hasn't been run here, but demonstrably from 2018 to 2020, that stock has materially outperformed. The other one, which is terrifying in some ways to be betting against the Oracle, but we think there's good reason to be doing so, is in the airline industry. And we don't invest directly in airlines and we sort of share. I think Buffett's been a little bit schizophrenic on this topic in terms of buying in and selling out of airlines and trying to get people to remind him never to do it again, but he's found himself there recently. He was a seller of airlines, and we were actually adding to one of our positions, which is a company called Hexcel, operates in a really cozy duopoly in the manufacture of carbon fiber for all of the shells or wings and body parts that go into the newest models of aircraft. And there's just a huge structural tailwind there, that part of the market where, you know, carbon fiber is five times lighter than aluminium. It's far stronger. It's going to every new aircraft that we can see in the market. So whilst we believe that, yes, there's going to be a short-term headwind here of sort of even up to a couple of years, Hexcel is very well placed. It's got plenty of liquidity on the balance sheet. It's got a very large backlog of potential planes coming off the production units over the next few years. So whilst it wasn't a direct bet against Buffett, we were certainly heading in the opposite direction in terms of sector exposure. So I guess there are a couple of examples, one longer term and the second one a little bit shorter term.
Well, if you see Equity Mates Asset Management as a major shareholder when you're next doing your filters for this, then you know you're onto a winner. So stay tuned. Look, Nick, we'll move on to the last stock, and forgive me if I butcher this name, but Nemetschek Group. Is that
I'm
correct?
Very glad that I didn't have to introduce this one.
Nemetschek.
I'm glad you're not the only one who struggles with that name. I'm not the only one that struggles with that name. So it's a very interesting business. It's based up in Germany, and hence the name. And they are the pioneer in the digital transformation of the architecture, engineering, and construction industry. In fact, they're the number one in Europe, and they're a strong contender to a business you might be more familiar with, Autodesk in the US. So the original CAD/CAM guys in all things design. They cover the entire life cycle of the construction and infrastructure project. So if you think about a architect designing the plans, it used to be done on paper and pen, and then they take those plans, they give them to the builder, and the builder goes to the site and tries to put a building together, and then eventually that building's handed off to the maintenance staff. That's all put together by Nemetschek in a digital footprint now, which is pretty interesting. It's got a really interesting background where the founder was one of the first to use programs, and this was pre-PCs, for calculating the elements on heavily loaded, irregular, supported slabs in the building industry. So he goes back a long time to 1963 when he started doing this sort of work. He still owns 53% of the business, and the culture of the business is founded in what's called the Mittelstand principles in Germany, which is the small and mid-sized businesses in Germany that typically aren't listed. So it's usually quite hard to get exposure to these kinds of companies, but they're typically family ownership. They're built for the long term. They're highly independent, very small head offices, and quite nimble in the way that they go about things. It's quite interesting because their building clients typically operate on 3-5% margins, and 30% of the construction work is rework, and 40% of their projects are typically over budget. So Nemetschek can help their clients overcome these problems and eke out slightly better economics. And the nice thing also is that the growth is mandated. So a most recent example is the UK government is forcing the building companies to use what's called this BIM technology as part of their push to reduce build times and greenhouse gases by around 50%. So that's a nice tailwind. And there's also terrific upsell opportunities across the board where their existing clients don't usually use the full suite of offerings. So they might have one, but there's a nice attach rate opportunity where you can go from sort of one product to introducing 3-5 products over time. So very established in the developed world, but you've also got this tailwind as the emerging markets start to develop and building codes tighten and people get a little bit more sophisticated in the way they use this technology. We think there's a nice runway for growth in the emerging markets as well, which is an interesting place to be. The economics are phenomenal. They've got sort of 95% customer retention rates. There's no one customer that's more than 1% of their revenues. And it seems to me that a lot of the stimulus that's going into fiscal at the moment is really aimed towards this infrastructure and building part of economy. So we think they're terrifically well placed, and we're able to pick up some stock during the nadir of markets in March and April.
Mm. Now, Nick, I'm going to make an assumption about you, and please forgive me if I'm wrong and please correct me, but I'm going to guess that you're not an architect by trade or you haven't worked in the construction industry.
Imagine if you did.
Yeah. Well, then we'd just edit this out in post. But I am interested, you were throwing some terms around there, some construction industry terms I wasn't familiar with, and it got me thinking around the concept of a circle of competence. And when you're talking about a business like this, which is not a niche industry, but quite a specialized industry. How did you go about educating yourself about this industry and trying to understand if their products were actually good and if there was actually a product market fit there?
Well, the nice thing is that even not being a specialist, you can get pretty close to the answer by looking at the outcomes of the business. So we are all set up as generalists here at Fairlight, and we do have some specialties running through. I mean, Ian, who's the co-portfolio manager of the product, has a prior history in the healthcare space. So that certainly helps. And once you start to get into the more technical ends of healthcare, that can be pretty important, and it does help expand our circle of competence. But the kind of businesses we try to invest in, we just stick to those that can be understood by, you know, a reasonable, intelligent person that does a lot of reading. So I don't think it's beyond the capabilities of anyone on the listening to this podcast to understand what Nemetschek does. If you get into the specifics, then that's all well and good. But really, if you understand the process of what they're trying to do and the outcome of that, and whether it's demonstrable in their numbers, then you're in a pretty good spot. So, you know, they're making claims that they can, you know, reduce the cost for their customers. You know, what are their customers saying? What is the results that's coming through in their financials? What does the customer retention rate looks like? So if they are making those kind of claims, you'd be expecting their customers to stick around. And in this case, and you've got 95 up to 97% customer retention rates year on year. It means that their clients are genuinely getting value out of the products that they're selling. So you need to cross-check what you think you know about the business against the actual results of the company. And in doing so, I think you can get pretty close to the answer without becoming a sort of 100% sort of nerd on the topic and having to understand you know, down to the product-specific level exactly, you know, how they're generating those numbers. We understand the unit economics, we understand the product, we understand the business. But at the end of the day, if you're getting stuck in the minutia, sometimes you're missing the forest from the trees.
Mm. And that's what we love about investing. I think, you know, it just gives you exposure to so many niche industries that you'd never otherwise be reading about. Well, can't say that for everyone, but I certainly wouldn't be reading about these sorts of industries. Now, Nick, before we get to our final three questions, this is actually the first guest we have asked this question. We are in the process now of building out the Equity Mates hypothetical portfolio, and a component of that is to get a stock on a watch list, not a buy, hold, sell recommendation, but purely a watch list from all of the guests that are experts that we interview. So if we were to take the Ritchie Brothers, Verisk Analytics, or Nemetschek Group, of those three, if you were to just choose one to put on a watch list, what would that be?
I think it would be Ritchie Brothers. And the reason I say that is I think I wouldn't be true to form if I'd been laying the boot into the Australian stock market by saying it's overvalued and then not be somewhat price sensitive. So Nemetschek has re-rated pretty heavily since we bought it. We've actually been trimming that position, and Verisk as well from a multiple point of view is certainly getting up to a point where we're looking to take some capital out. But Ritchie Brothers is sub 30 times earnings, and the near term is sort of clouding the possible earnings power of this business over the next few years. So I'd vote for Ritchie Brothers.
Nice. Well, the inaugural watch list stock.
It begins.
Love it.
Please don't get me back on the show if it underperforms.
Oh, no. Well, it's out there now.
So, Nick, as Bryce said, we do like to finish this interview with the three same final questions. Before we do, I'm sure a lot of listeners have had their interest piqued hearing you talk about your investing philosophy and then applying it to some specific businesses. If people want to find out more about you, follow you online, or find out more about Fairlight, what would be the best place for them to do that?
Oh, easy. Check out our website, fairlightam.com.au, and you can sign up for our distribution list, and we'll punch you out monthly insights to your email address. And what we try and write about there is either a stock or a topic of interest, so we don't blast you with sort of how markets have moved over the last month. I think there's enough of that out there, but we do try and lift the covers a little bit on how we think and reveal a little bit about some businesses that we think are interesting.
Nice.
Nice one. I love that. I don't think there's enough of that out there. I think there's way too much of that out there. So it's great that the content isn't just what did markets do yesterday.
Yeah, exactly right. We agree.
We'll get to these final three questions. The first one is, do you have any books that you consider must read? And now this can be investing or otherwise.
Well, I think that you've probably heard enough of Buffett, Peter Lynch and Fisher over the last sort of few months that you've been doing this. So I'll skip all those or required reading, and I'll take those as read. But a few that have spoken to me over time, and a couple that are more recent. The first one that I read quite some time ago, but really struck me as an interesting read. Have you guys read Endurance by Ernest Shackleton?
No.
Or the story of Ernest Shackleton? It's an incredible story. So it was Ernest Shackleton's failed attempt to cross Antarctica via the South Pole. And not only did he fail, but he didn't manage to step foot on Antarctica because his boat was his ship was trapped between ice and cracked up and ultimately sunk. And he and his crew drifted on drift ice until they hit a place called Elephant Island, which is really a remote spot. And Shackleton realized that they were so far out of regular shipping lanes that the chance of their ultimate rescue was pretty remote. So instead, he set sail with a crew of five members on a 20-foot skiff for a smaller island called South Georgia, located off Argentina. And his crew was left on Elephant Island living off seal meat and living under an upturned boat for almost 2 years. They
what?
Survived.
Wow. Yeah,
exactly right. And so ultimately Shackleton returned with a rescue mission, and 100% of his team survived. It's one of the most remarkable stories of teamwork, navigation and survival in my view ever written. It's quite astonishing. So
wow.
I put that one out there as a really interesting true story and one that, you know, resonates with me from a teamwork point of view. The other two, I noticed that you had Ed Cowan from TDM Partners on during June, and the Fairlight team were quite good friends with the TDM guys, more specifically Tom and Hamish, who we've got to know over the years. But we share a mutual appreciation for the importance of company culture. And so one that I've read recently is called Powerful. I don't know if you guys have read that one. It's the story put together by the chief talent officer at Netflix, a lady called Patty McCord. And it's not the memoir of Netflix, but it instead offers some really refreshing insights into how to build a high-performing culture that can really adapt to what we're seeing in the business world at the moment. And it suggests, amongst many things, and these all resonate with me pretty strongly, and probably you guys as well in the corporate structures that maybe you found yourself working in, but ditching the dreaded annual performance review and many of the company perks that have been sort of employed to motivate or try to motivate team members. And instead, it really puts forward the notion of providing people with really challenging work and encouraging productive debate across all levels of the organization, and making sure people are empowered to get their jobs done and work quite autonomously, creating that real sense of mission. It's a really useful read if you're looking to build a business or analysing companies for possible investment, if you want to understand their culture. And the last one, along the same bent, and it's only because I've been reading about these, so I've put them down as a theme, but the other one is Creativity Inc., written by Ed Catwell, who's the longtime president of Pixar. No, of course, Pixar created some of those great stories that I'm going to learn a lot more about now that I've become a dad, but with a great programs such as Toy Story and some of those other amazing creative movies that have been put together. But the key point in that book is that having a good team is more important than having a good idea. And never blame the failures on a single person. Always hold the entire team responsible for your decisions. And there's one quote in there that really resonated with me, and that's essentially, if you give a good idea to a mediocre team, they'll screw it up. If you give a mediocre idea to a brilliant team, they'll either fix it, throw it away, or come up with something better. And I think that's 100% true. So I think that culture beats strategy 100 times out of one.
Yeah, nice.
I like that. I like that. Three great book recommendations. So the second question that we have is, what's your go-to source for investing and financial information?
Yeah, we lean really heavily on the literature that's actually produced directly by the companies. So annual reports, quarterly releases, conference notes, proxy statements, and all that sort of stuff. It might be boring, but we find that collating the information from the source rather than relying on brokers or blogs or other authors out there helps us form independent views. And I think that independent views are critically important if you're making investment mistakes. And we do also try to speak to management to glean some insights regarding culture and strategy. I know that's not available to everyone, but it's something that's been pretty important to our process. I'd definitely read as many of the investor letters out there. So if you go to sort of the 13F filings that you can find and letters that are put out over time, you can really come across some interesting things. And then the usual suspects in terms of financial press is a good place to understand sort of what's happening from a strategy point of view. So we read the FT, the Wall Street Journal, the usual suspects, but there's nothing proprietary in that. But being broadly informed is a very good place to be.
Nice one. And then the last question, if you think back to your early days as an investor when you were just starting out and investing in that first air conditioning company whose name has escaped me at the moment.
It hasn't escaped me. It's called Hasty Air Conditioning. It's etched into my mind.
There you go, Hasties. If you think back to those days, what advice would you have for your younger self?
I'll answer that from an investment point of view. And if we have time and you have the appetite, I can give you one from a personal point of view. But from an investing point of view, I think if you study the characteristics of most highly successful investors and traders, you'll find they possess a pretty common set of characteristics. And I think that really comes through in guys like Stanley Druckenmiller, for instance, who's been honing his craft over some many years and maybe was perhaps blessed with some of these characteristics from birth. But the four that come to mind are mental flexibility. The second is an ability to think independently. The third is a tireless inquisitiveness, and perhaps most importantly, a deep self-awareness. But if I was going to give my younger self some advice to concentrate on just one of these characteristics, it would be to become ruthlessly accelerate my development of mental flexibility. I have a deep respect for the wisdom of crowds, and don't be contrarian for the sake of it, only when it makes sense. In other words, be sure that the wisdom of crowds is truly turned into the madness of crowds before taking contrarian bet. It just doesn't make sense to do so otherwise. And then get very, very good at blowing up your closest held personal beliefs when faced with compelling contradicting evidence. Sort of being belligerently stubborn has no place in finance and for that matter, I don't think in life at all. So that would be my advice to my younger self from an investing point of view.
Love it, Nick. We'll leave it there. And, you know, it's been a fascinating conversation. As we said at the start of the show, the small caps space is always something of interest for us and for our audience. So we really appreciate you coming on the show and not only sharing with us three stocks that you're interested in, but giving us the inaugural watch list stock, which we're super pumped about.
how terrifying.
Look, we can't thank you enough for sharing your insight with us tonight. So very much appreciate you coming on the show, and we look forward to staying in touch and watching the progress of Fairlight. So big thanks.
Thanks, Bryson. Thanks, Alec. And big congratulations for you guys for building what seems to be a growing and a very insightful podcast.
Thanks, Nick.
Thanks for listening to Equity Mates Investing Podcast, a production of Equity Mates Media. Please remember that everything you hear in Equity Mates Investing Podcast is general advice only. The content has been prepared without knowing your personal objectives, specific financial circumstances, or goals. The host of Equity Mates Investing Podcast may maintain positions in the companies discussed. Before considering any investment, please read the product disclosure statement and consider speaking to a licensed financial professional.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.